This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is off this week. Coming up, it's been 10 years since the U.S. tried to shock and awe the world with its invasion of Iraq. Opponents of stop and frisk put the New York City Police Department on trial, and Black federal employees challenge President Obama to take a stand on civil rights. But first, the mostly Black city of Detroit is about to lose control of its finances. The Republican governor of Michigan appointed Kevin Orr, a Black attorney with a right-wing law firm, to oversee Detroit's financial affairs. Butch Hollowell is general counsel for the Detroit NAACP. He says Kevin Orr is bad news.
He comes from a law firm that represents Wells Fargo, and they are the number one firm in the nation that has done more foreclosures in Detroit and the state of Michigan than any other firm. As 7,800 new residents just got put on the treasurer's list for new foreclosures, their firm has been at the leader of taking people's dreams away. And furthermore, studies indicate that Wells Fargo is also the number one company in the city for not paying their own property taxes. Now, they're talking about, you know, bringing in this financial manager, and one of his main clients doesn't pay taxes to the city that needs the money. So, first of all, that question has to be answered. The second thing is, he represents Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Citigroup. Now, these are three of the firms that not only got, between them, billions in TARP bailouts, but they're also the same ones that defrauded people into signing some of these leases in predatory lending, which caused the crash of the housing market. This is what was the main cause of the problems that we've had in the economy, and Detroit has been hit harder than any place in the country on that score. The third problem that we have with the firm that Mr. Orr comes from is that he apparently is chairman of the diversity committee, but the problem is they have no diversity in that firm. It's one of the world's largest law firms, and they were founded back in the 1800s and didn't have their first Black partner until 1982. As of today, they were given a grade of F, as it relates to the number of those that they would give partnership to. So they've got a terrible track record. So how are you going to come into a city like Detroit, which celebrates its diversity? We love our diversity here, but a firm that doesn't know anything about it, apparently. So we have lots of problems as it relates to Mr. Orr's background.
So Mr. Orr and the fact that he's Black is just a kind of icing on a very nasty cake.
We've seen this movie before, right? We understand what Clarence Thomas has done on the Supreme Court to African Americans. He may look like us, but he certainly has done us no favors as it relates to the law and issues of justice for people of color. He, again, his pattern has been never to say anything, you know, at oral arguments during the Supreme Court. And as the court just the week before last considered the Voting Rights Act, again, he didn't utter a word on maybe the most important piece of legislation that any nation has ever passed as it relates to voting rights, ever. So just because you look like us doesn't necessarily mean that it's in the people of color's interest. And so this individual, just because he's an African-American, is going to have to answer some very tough questions. And in my book, as chief counsel for the NAACP, in my book, the biggest question is, if he wanted to be here so bad, he should come here and run for mayor. He should register as a resident here and run for mayor. We have a thing called election. We have an elected mayor. We have an elected city council. And by putting in these emergency managers, which are really dictators, they have the authority to dissolve governments. They have the authority to pass laws. They have the authority to cancel contracts and collective bargaining agreements. This is what dictators do. This is not what we do in democracy.
And so, in fact, if you have a city manager, one should really not even be thinking about running for mayor. That's a devalued job.
It's a devalued job. You said a mouthful. We have a set of laws under the 14th Amendment called one man, one vote. You know, really one person, one vote. But what that means is that my vote should be equal to your vote. And your vote should not mean more than my vote. This is one of the great tenets that we say that we want to have in terms of a democracy. But under an emergency manager form of government, my elected officials have virtually no power. So that means that my vote is worth less than someone else who lives in another city in Michigan that doesn't have an emergency manager. So, like, it goes back to the three-fifths clause. You know, my vote's worth 10% and your vote is worth 100%. This does violence to both the non-dilution clause, which is Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, but it also does violence to that section of the 14th Amendment that we call our one man, one vote.
Yes, the fact that most of these cities and school systems that are targeted for these emergency managers are largely black is not coincidental, is it?
Not coincidental, and we think deliberate. They have not put emergency managers in any other place except for one place, which asked for one. So Allen Park is the only exception. Other than that, the only communities that they've put emergency managers in have been African-American communities, to the extent that today 49% of all Michiganians of color have emergency managers at the head. And this is after just this past November, not 2 Novembers ago or 10 years ago. This past November, this question was on the ballot as to whether Michigan wanted an emergency manager law, and they overwhelmingly rejected it. These are voters statewide. But in the dead of night, during what they call a lame duck session, just before Christmas, the Republican members of the legislature decided that they knew what was best, better than what the people knew, and they passed this law to be put in place in the face of the will of the people. So we're not going to take this. We believe very strongly in our rights. We gave too much in order to win those rights, and we won't give them up without a fight.
Mr. Orr and his law firm seem to embody a not just corporate takeover of Detroit, but a finance corporate takeover, a finance sector that was bailed out to the tune of many billions and billions of dollars. But you asked the question, where was the Detroit bailout?
Right. Where's our TARP money? Now, his clients got TARP money. They got billions of dollars for that. And here's the other little secret that people seem to not know. Detroit is the only donor city in the state of Michigan. That means that we're the only city that contributes more to the state's general fund budget, and we get less back than we put in. So they're taking Detroit's money. They squeezed the city because of they took away residency. In other words, we had a law that said if you work for the city, you need to live in the city. That cost the city millions of dollars. They put in a place where the Republicans took away the personal property tax, cost us millions of dollars, took away what we call revenue sharing. This is based on the money that we put in. We should be able to get some money back. They have severely restricted that. And then they've underfunded our schools, taken money from public schools, put them into prisons and charter schools. And then they say, oh, you guys can't pay your bills.
And so Detroit is characterized as a deadbeat that must be bankrupted.
And in fact, we subsidize the rest of the state. We provide the water system for the entire state, and we put billions of dollars in infrastructure for that water system that services people throughout the state of Michigan without so much as a nickel from the rest of them as it relates to how we built that system and extended that system so that everyone could have fresh drinking water. We provide the museums, and we provide the entertainment, and we provide the sports venues, and we provide all the arts and the culture and the beat and the life that you would find in a city. And yet, they would try to take away our assets, and we're going to fight that.
Attorney Butch Hollowell, General Counsel for the Detroit NAACP. Trial starts this week in the federal class action suit against New York City's infamous stop and frisk policies. The plaintiffs are seeking damages for the hundreds of thousands of men of color targeted each year and for an end to racial profiling. Vince Warren is executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He says it took years just to win the right to bring the class action suit to trial.
Yes, it has. We learned back in 1999 when Amadou Diallo was gunned down in a hail of bullets for really nothing more than being black, standing in front of his building and holding a wallet that the police mistook for a gun, that the NYPD was out of control when it came to stopping and confronting black men on the street. As a result of the lawsuit that we filed in that case in 1999, we were successful in getting rid of the street crimes unit, which had been doing a lot of the stop and frisk and was given virtually unfettered discretion to stop and frisk black and brown men whenever they wanted. And as a result of that lawsuit, we settled it. The unit was disbanded. And the police promised that they would change, but they didn't. And as a result, from 2002 to 2011, the number of people stopped by the New York Police Department increased by 600%. And in 2012 and 2011, 87% of the people that they stopped were African American and Latino, even though African Americans and Latinos make up only 53% of the city's population. So of the more than 500,000 stops that the police have been doing recently, the vast majority, almost 90%, are men of color.
Now, many of us think those numbers speak for themselves, but what do you have to prove in court?
The lawsuit is based in the 14th Amendment and the 4th Amendment. The 4th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures by any government entity, including, in this case, the police department. And the 14th Amendment has the guarantee of equal protection, so it prohibits treating particularly African American and Latino people differently than white people because of their race. So what we have to show is, number one, that we have to demonstrate the massive number of stops that the police do each year, and we need to show that they are not based on what we know is a reasonable, an articulable, and individualized assessment of whether the person has committed a crime or not. And so looking at the massive number of stops and then using the police's own data as to why they stop these people, we show that the vast majority of people that are stopped are not stopped because the police have a reasonable, articulable, or individualized suspicion, but they're stopped in terms of a policy of stopping people that they think are likely to commit crimes, as opposed to people that they have a reasonable suspicion have committed a crime.
And, of course, they will deny to the end that this is a racialized policy. They will claim that it is a policy based on areas of crime.
They already have said that, and they've been saying that for a while. But the numbers tell a very, very different story. We also know that there's no published study that shows that this stop-and-frisk practice reduces crime. And, in fact, when you begin to look at the numbers that the police department are giving you, for example, if you look at guns, you hear that the police department says this is because we want to get guns off the street and save lives. But of the over 500,000 stops, less than 1% of those stops result in recovery of a gun. The vast majority of those stops are really for harassment and crowd control purposes as well.
Now, stop and frisk declined, I believe, 28% last year, clearly because of orders from on high. That in itself would say that stop and frisk is not just a policy of officers responding to situations as they see them on the street, but a policy directed from above at these targeted communities.
Oh, that's exactly right. That this is a problem that starts at the top. This is not a bottom-up policy. This is not a bunch of rogue officers. This is the policy of the New York City Police Department. So by showing them the reduction of stops that have happened recently, it doesn't necessarily show that the New York City Police Department is doing a better job, but what it does show is that they have complete control over the job that they do. And so what we're looking for is an end to this policy. It starts from the police commissioner and the mayor all the way down. They can do it. There are better forms of policing that will be more likely to keep communities safe, that will be more likely to get guns off the street, and that will be more likely to keep whole communities from being harassed the way that they currently are now.
And if stop and frisk is a violation of constitutional law, if it is a crime, then cutting stop and frisk in half or even 90% does not do away with the crime.
No, that's exactly right. We're not playing a game of inches here. There are lives that are at stake. There are entire communities that are at stake. And what we're focusing on, and to be clear, is we're focusing on unconstitutional stop and frisks. These are the stop and frisks that the police department does without any connection to a reasonable and articulable suspicion. And not only is it good policy for them to stop doing it, and not only will it be good for the communities for them to stop doing it, because they're essentially targeting innocent people when they do this, it actually complies with the law. The Constitution demands that there are only certain criteria in which they are allowed to stop and frisk people. The police department isn't stopping and frisking anybody. And a significant cut in the unconstitutional stop and frisk, we want that down to zero. That will comply with the law. That will make communities safer. That will have better relationships between police and the community. And I think more importantly, African American, Latino men in particular can breathe a sigh of relief because they won't have to worry about the police rolling up on them for no reason when they're just going down to get a quart of milk. And parents won't have to tell their kids and to counsel and teach their kids how to survive a stop and frisk on their way to and from school. That's the world that we want to live in. That's the New York that we want as well.
So in this courtroom, it will be the Center for Constitutional Rights and other plaintiffs who are the actors in favor of law enforcement and the city of New York that is the outlaw.
That's right. The Center for Constitutional Rights is challenging and putting the New York City police practice on trial, and we're doing it in conjunction with two wonderful law firms, the firm of Belbach, Levine & Hoffman, the law firm of Covington & Burling. And in addition to that, CCR is a very proud member of a broad-based coalition here in New York City that covers all five boroughs, which is called the Communities United for Police Reform. 26 organizations that bring together members, lawyers, researchers, activists to move together and to create legislation and fixes for this problem that has been plaguing New York for a very long time.
Vince Warren of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. This week marks the 10th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. We spoke with veteran anti-war activist David Swanson, publisher of the influential website War is a Crime, and we asked him, what has the last decade seen in terms of resistance to the U.S. war machine at home and abroad?
Well, we've seen an anti-war movement that's fallen short of some in the past, including in our own country, including during the Vietnam War by various measures, including during the period between the two world wars when there was a very vibrant and proactive anti-war movement. But we've seen a movement that was there, that was significant, that was having an impact, that was building international power with allies in other countries, including those being victimized by our own, but much more during the Bush administration than during the Obama. And in fact, when the Democrats came into Congress in 2007 and the following years, the peace movement gradually fell off, and that's very, very discouraging. I think the most positive development we've seen is largely due to a particular bit of Bushian incompetence in the way of telling lies, but we have a strong majority of the country to this day understanding that President Bush intentionally lied the nation into a war. You don't have that understanding that every war is based on lies, and sometimes the liars are more skillful, but it's progress. On the other hand, you have intense devastation in the nation of Iraq and virtual ignorance of it in the United States. You have a majority of Americans believing that Iraqis benefited from this war, whereas the United States suffered. You have a plurality of Americans believing that Iraqis not only should be grateful, but are grateful, are in fact grateful for what we've done to them since 2003. Since 2003, this war, by the most scientific measurements available, has killed 1.4 million Iraqis. That's 5% of that nation. That is more than most nations have lost in most wars ever. That's twice what the United States lost in the Civil War. That's higher than many nations, including the United States, Britain, Japan, France, lost in World War II. So this is a major, major devastation of a nation that destroyed the infrastructure, created 4.5 million refugees, has devastated the society, has left behind cluster bombs, depleted uranium, white phosphorus poisoning. You have birth defects in Fallujah. You have cancer rates in Basra through the roof. And you have Americans imagining that Iraqis are grateful. So something's broken down in our communication system.
Yes, and most Americans don't seem to understand that the United States was forced out not just by armed resistance, but by Iraqi civil society.
Oh, incredible nonviolent resistance and political organization and labor movement organization, resistance in southern Iraq and elsewhere to the takeover of oil by foreign corporations, a struggle that is ongoing, and resistance by the U.S. puppet Iraqi government to the extent that it was representing Iraqi interests to ongoing U.S. occupation and to ongoing U.S. occupation with immunity for crimes. And this, of course, was a big point for the Obama administration, which wanted to keep troops in violation of the treaty that Bush and Maliki had put together, but wasn't going to do so unless those troops and mercenaries could have immunity from criminal prosecution for their inevitable crimes. Thus, we had the celebration of Obama's supposed decision to withdraw from Iraq, something that, in fact, he did much more slowly than advertised in his first campaign for the White House, something which, in fact, he did when compelled to by a treaty that predated his administration.
You are a student of the peace movement, a student of peace movement history. Nowadays, we have a regime that obscures the whole definition of war. What is a state of peace and what is a state of war? And is there such a thing as permanent war?
Well, there seems to be at the moment. There is an authorization to use military force that was put through Congress 3 days after 9/11 that has been gradually expanded and expanded to cover not only those responsible for 9/11, but those associated with someone who knows someone who had contact with someone associated with organizations that assisted in some way with 9/11. And that's not good enough for these guys. They are talking in the White House and in parts of Congress about an expanded new authorization that would allow presidents to make war without having to figure out some sort of remote connection with 9/11. This would be permanent war without limit in time or space. This is what they are openly talking about and already acting as if it exists. You know, we have these wars supposedly for our rights, and our rights vanish under the excuse that it's wartime, but there's no sort of time limit. So the warrantless spying that's been expanded and made permanent, the imprisonment without charge and trial, the now open Tuesday terror meetings assassination program, the drone strikes, the unconstitutional wars in places like Libya, these are all part of a permanent war state of mind and state of politics. And the understanding now is widespread in Washington that presidents get to decide on matters of war, not Congress. In fact, there's a resolution in the Senate that would effectively allow the nation of Israel to launch the United States into a war against Iran, which would outdo congressional transfer of power to the White House by transferring war-making power to a foreign nation. But these are all things that would have been unimaginable 15 years ago. If Bill Clinton had proposed to meet every Tuesday and go through a list of men, women, and children and pick which ones to kill and kill them, I strongly suspect he would have been impeached, whether he, you know, unzipped his pants or not. But after the Bush administration and after zero accountability, Barack Obama has been able to come in and do these things almost unquestioned.
So the United States is in a state of war whenever the president says it is, for as long as he says it is. But this president says that U.S. involvement in Afghanistan ends at the end of 2014, yet he still wants to keep lots of killing power in that country.
Right. I mean, that having an occupation, quote unquote, end comes down to the definition of the word end, just as an imminent threat means sometime eventually before the world is over. And the way that these people play with words, you're already giving in the U.S. media President Obama credit for quote-unquote ending a war over a period of time, over 2 years, that's longer than most wars in history have taken from beginning to end. We're taking this war from 11 years up to 13 years and calling that additional pointless, murderous two-year period ending the war in order to give the president extended credit for that supposed action. And yet, when you look into the details, there is no intention whatsoever of actually ending the U.S. military presence. The plan is to keep a significant number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan, as it was, although it failed, in Iraq. Although, of course, we now hear about the CIA's enlargement of their operations in Iraq in their supposed effort to stop terrorism in both Iraq and Syria.
And the United States hardly ever uses the term that you just used, occupation. That is, admit that it's in a state of occupation of many countries.
Yeah, you know, I was watching a basketball game yesterday, and they were thanking troops for, U.S. troops for viewing from 175 nations. And, you know, recently it was 177. I don't know if somebody recalculated, if there are two countries that we actually left, but there are, of course, numerous countries beyond that 177 that are not on the list, that are just being moved into now, that are places where so-called special forces are operating. And then there are significant cold occupations, including Germany and Japan, which the United States will never leave, as World War II has never really ended. And there are occupations like Iraq and like Afghanistan that we ought to be done with, but are clearly nothing other than wars made by a very powerful nation on impoverished nations very far away. And so this pretense in the U.S. media that the war lasted until George W. said the mission was accomplished, after which it was a civil war, which should be blamed on the backwardness and ignorance of millennia-old rivalries and the stupidity of the Muslim faith and so forth, is just outrageous. You can look into the details of how the United States armed religious fanatics to go after other religious fanatics and instigated sectarian strife and encouraged what has now been a segregation of Iraqi society that really does threaten a civil war, and it's just ludicrous to blame that on the victims.
A new UN report says that U.S. drone policy in Pakistan violates that country's sovereignty.
Well, obviously not. The United States maintains the right to go into any nation anywhere in order to, what they call target, what I call murder, individuals. Now, it gets a little complicated in that the United States government cooperates with foreign governments against the will and the public understanding of their nations. And so the Pakistani government will sometimes claim to be against something, and behind closed doors, perhaps it's for it. But when you have members of the Pakistani government publicly demanding repeatedly that the United States cease and desist, and openly advocating and explaining an understanding of the fact that the people of Pakistan have turned dramatically against the United States because of these drone strikes. And when you have a refugee crisis of millions of people fleeing northern Pakistan because of the intense missile strikes from drones, you're talking about a new kind of war and a new kind of crime that has sort of slipped right past the idea of whether Congress will declare or authorize war, or the United Nations or any other body will somehow, quote unquote, legally sanction the war, because it's seen as something other than war. Just as the president's lawyer, Harold Koh, went into Congress and said that bombing Libya would not be war, it would not even be hostilities, it would be non-hostile bombs. The president went through a number of lawyers unwilling to say that before he found one who was. But this is the new model. You call it something other than war. You maintain that drone strikes are better than ground wars. But you know, we didn't have ground wars in Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia. We replaced nothing with drone wars. And this is the temptation that we're now bringing into our own country with domestic drone programs. This is a disastrous course for anybody who is concerned about peace in the world.
Elections are set for April 14th to succeed Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who succumbed to cancer this month. The United States has been trying to get rid of Chavez ever since he first won election in 1998, and they backed a coup against him in 2002. Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, expects the U.S. to continue to try to destabilize Venezuela.
I don't think the United States is through with Venezuela, but I don't think that Venezuela and what it represents over either. I think that Venezuela was a symptom of a real shift in the balance of power that has been occurring for a while now, that has startled the United States, and Hugo Chavez, of course, himself, and what he represented in South America was something that startled them. They were in the process of dancing on the grave of Fidel Castro, anticipating that he would die and what it was going to mean in terms of how they were going to be able to change things in Cuba, that is the imperialist, the United States government. And then, of course, what happened was with the election of Hugo Chavez and then with his return to power after the United States played a role in getting him out of there temporarily, it became clear through the actions of the masses of people in solidarity with Chavez that Fidelismo has moved beyond Cuba and that it was sweeping South America. The reality is that people just refuse to live anymore as a doormat for the United States or for imperialism, that they want to use their resources to serve their own interests. And increasingly, that's what's shaping how everything is happening in the world today. So they certainly will continue to try and destabilize the situation in Venezuela. In fact, the Venezuelan government, I think right on the eve of Chavez's announced death, had expelled two U.S. military attaché because they were involved in attempting to initiate a coup in Venezuela. I expect to see more. I think more is happening now that we don't see. And if it were not happening, then it would be something that was seriously different from how the United States has always acted toward any force that was challenging its hegemony any place in the world. So Venezuela was a situation of you had these uppity people who assumed that they could run their own lives based on their own needs and requirements as opposed to serving some need of the United States. So, yeah, it's not over yet.
Hugo Chavez's government also put the light on the racial circumstances in Latin America in ways that had not been so dramatic in the past.
I think that's true. I think most people have never quite understood the situation in South America. And if you look at that as an example, the media, the bourgeoisie, the ruling class, while not reporting on a damn thing that's happening of any real significance to us, like the murder of this youngster in Brooklyn, are talking about the first non-European pope in more than 1,000 years, when they actually have a European pope now from the colonizers that came to South America. In this instance, they're talking about the Argentinian, who is European. One of the things that makes Chavez significant and makes Morales in Bolivia significant is the class structure throughout South America for the longest period of time. And up until now, what we've seen is that the ruling class throughout South America has always been white or mestizo, white and Indian mixed. And they lived in the centers, in the major urban areas, while the indigenous people who lived in the countryside and, of course, a huge African population that's extremely impoverished as well. And people have assumed that when you hear about the struggle to free Venezuela from Spanish rule, that it meant that the white folks was gone. Throughout South America, that was the case, but it wasn't the case. It was just another group of white people, just like in the United States, who fought what they call a war of independence against England in this instance. But it was one group of white people fighting another group of white people to take the land of the indigenous population where Africans had been utilized to build the economy. And similarly, in South America, that was the case. And so Chavez, being of African and indigenous ancestry, and Morales being indigenous person, this is a real shift. And it has been unspoken for the longest period of time that even when you look at Noriega in Panama, part of the reason that he was hated so much by the upper class in Panama because he was not white. And Chavez himself was able to say that he's aware that one of the reasons that there's so much antagonism against him about the upper classes is that he is not white, that he is of African and indigenous extraction. So this is a part of what I really believe is this whole movement that's shifting the whole balance of power in the whole world, where people who have been historically oppressed and whose resources and lands have been the basis for enriching Europe and North America, white people in general, if you will, this shift is the thing that is represented by Hugo Chavez, and that's why I'm saying that despite his death, that they will, that is to say the United States and the imperialists, will not be able to stop this historical process that's unfolding right under their feet.
And although the U.S. corporate media downplays race in South America in general, and even in Venezuela, the small ruling white elite, the group that still controls economic power even in Venezuela, made no bones about drawing pictures, editorial cartoons in their newspapers of Chavez as a monkey and routinely referring to him as that monkey.
That's right. And we saw similar things about this group that they were upholding in Libya, didn't we? When they would refer to Gaddafi and his curly hair and what have you and make what are clearly racially based insults against him. And I think this is a part of the tussle, you know, that we are looking at right now where people want to define this struggle in purely economic terms. The reality is that the ideological influence of race is something that represents itself in the real world, and that this ideological influence has its basis in a material reality of white power, white resources, white wealth coming at the expense of the freedom and the resources of African and Asian and indigenous peoples throughout the world. So this is what it is that we're looking at. This is a magnificent transformation that's happening in the world that I think made a Barack Hussein impossible necessary, again, because of how things are shifting. And this is much deeper than just that. I mean, even when you look at just how the people are reproducing themselves around the world, the demographically, how Europeans are not having enough children to reproduce their populations. I mean, I think this is a part of the whole frantic shifting that is happening in the world and part of what guarantees that real transformation is happening despite what the U.S. and others will try to do. Venezuela is going to be seen, I believe, as not peculiar, but it's established of what the new standard in the world is, and that human progress will be measured by the kinds of events that we have seen happen in Venezuela, that's happening in Bolivia, that's happening even in places like Afghanistan and Iran and other places in historical terms. So it's a new era, and the reality is that Europeans are going to have to find a way to get a job just like everybody else, because it's not going to be like it has been anymore. We've entered a whole new door has been opened to history. And Hugo Chavez was representative of that in a splendid way, in the sense that history thrust him forward. He came out of this process in a very dramatic way. And in many ways, I suspect that the possibilities will be even greater now that Chavez is not on the scene, because the masses seem to be really trying to push this process forward in Venezuela. And I think we will see that as something that will continue to electrify the imagination of masses of oppressed people, not only in South America, but my experience has been in Africa, that Hugo Chavez and what was happening in Venezuela is a template that people were using to suggest this is what should be happening here in Africa as well.
The majority of South America's population is non-white, whether they consider themselves black or not, and there, of course, cannot be any left politics without that kind of understanding.
I think that's one of the reasons for the certain kind of frantic activity that's happening in the United States. I think Egypt and what's trying to happen there is a part of it. I think Tunisia is a part of it. I think that's the reason that the U.S. and its so-called allies are involved in trying to stop history in places like Syria, why they had to overthrow Gaddafi. I think this shift in the balance of power is not something that's restricted to South America. They saw it in the Middle East and tried to contain it there and killing people right now to try to maintain their stranglehold there. They see it in the Pacific Asian basin with the emergence of China as this new force there that's challenging U.S. and white Western imperialist hegemony in that area of the world. They doing everything they can to hold on to Africa, partially because they now have to contend with a China, with an India, with other forces for hegemony in Africa, and also because they have to anticipate that African people ourselves might want to, like everybody else around the world, might want to possess the resources of Africa, which seem never to run out for the benefit of Africa and African people. It is just a really new world that's happening under the feet of the imperialists, and they don't have enough drones, they don't have enough troops to put all around the world in order to hold this thing back. So I just think that the arrival of Chavez has been really important. It broke up the isolation of Cuba, And we don't know at this moment, do we, how successful this relationship with Cuba and Venezuela will be. A lot is still up in the air because they didn't have a socialist revolution in Venezuela. They don't have a socialist government in Venezuela. They have an important historical trajectory. They had a government that was comprised of different kinds of social forces with more or less the same state apparatus in place that was there when Chavez came to power. But underneath all of that, there is what appears to be a real growing popular people's militia where people are armed and people are seem to be really pushing to advance the promises that were made for a socialist future for the people there. It's an exciting period, but it's fraught with contradictions, which is one of the reasons why I think it was important for the Black is Back Coalition to have the mobilization that we did in Washington, D.C. at the State Department to say hands off Venezuela, that we in solidarity with Venezuela, just to call attention to the fact that we are aware of the machinations of the U.S. and particularly in that area and trying to overturn the victory that the people had won. And also because we agree with the probability that Hugo Chavez was correct, that the Venezuelans are correct, that they killed him. We are highly suspicious of the death by cancer of all these, you know, left to progressive heads of state in South America. We are certain that the U.S. and the illegitimate Israeli state has something to do with killing Arafat, that they've tried for years and years and years to murder Fidel Castro, that they did kill Bobby Hutt, they did kill Martin Luther King, they did kill Malcolm X, and that's the history of imperialism. And if they didn't kill Hugo Chavez, it certainly will not be for lack of trying. So it's a future that I think has all kinds of promise, but is fraught with all kinds of contradictions, and the people have to be alert and to get organized to deal with it.
That was Omali Yeshetela, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition, speaking from St. Petersburg, Florida. A petition's being circulated urging President Obama to sign an executive order that puts teeth in laws protecting federal employees' civil rights. Tanya Ward Jordan is a co-founder of the Coalition for Change. We reached her in Washington.
We're calling our campaign Unleash No Fear. It's addressing racism, race discrimination, and retaliation in the federal government. So what we're acting, the Coalition for Change, Inc., which is comprised of present and former federal employees, African Americans, who have been injured by workplace retaliation, discrimination in the government, we're asking the president to sign an executive order to mandate discipline for federal officials who have been found guilty of civil rights violations. Presently, when a manager discriminates or retaliates against any U.S. citizen, there is no mandatory discipline. And what we found is that persons, particularly African Americans in our community, are being hardest hit. And we're very disturbed to hear from a workforce perspective that too often they like to say that we're not educated or we don't have the degrees. Well, we find that we have ample degrees, and at the end of the day, we're pushed to the side, and therefore we find ourselves underemployed and unemployed. That's one part of it. The other piece of it is not just with regard to civil servants being impacted, our public's being impacted. The government covers everything from agriculture to veteran affairs. And you will find that across the board, in almost every major cabinet agency, you have class action complaints filed by African Americans. And this is a systemic problem. It can be addressed at the root. As President Obama, as the head of the executive branch, he could sign a mandate, an executive order to address this. Now, just to give you a little bit of background, in 2002, there was a law called the No Fear Act, the Notification and Employee Anti-Discrimination and Retaliation Act of 2002. Now, surprisingly, President Bush signed that law and Congress passed it in 2002. And although it was meant to deter discriminatory treatment, we look 11 years down the road and it's grown worse. The impact, everything's worse on African Americans, and it impacts worse on anyone. Any good person who wants to speak out against federal workplace abuse is impacted as well. So that's across color line. At the end of the day, however, No Fear Act 2002, while well-intended, it didn't go far enough. It asks that agencies report discipline, but it did not require agencies to impose discipline. So that's the loophole there. So the Coalition for Change, Inc., C4C members said, let's close the loophole. So we started this campaign called the Unleash No Fear campaign, and we posted a petition to the president on the change.org website. All of us are impacted by the federal government. If you go to the park, you have interior. If you eat the food, it's agriculture. You see veterans benefits, veteran affairs, Social Security. So it's across the board. And so this widespread abuse that is going on impacts all U.S. citizens. So we do invite everyone to sign the petition to help us in the violations that's going on across the board within our federal government.
Most people, I'm sure, assumed that federal officials who were found to have committed discriminatory acts were punished. And you're saying, no, it's not automatic.
It's not. In fact, one of our C4C members actually wrote the president. Surprisingly, they got a letter back, and it came through the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And I posted it, and I'm going to get right to your question, because a lot of people are surprised. They think that government discriminates against a U.S. citizen. At the end of the day, when you go to court, if someone's found guilty, something happens. No. The EEOC says they can only order agencies to consider discipline. Now, how ironic is that? Order you to consider. So that's a toothless mandate. And for this reason, these managers are violating civil rights with impunity, and systemic, and it's non-ending. And it's causing deep pain to our community. I have to share this. I went to a meeting. The NAACP actually sent an email to C4C, and I was invited to go to our local branch. There was a young lady there. She was with the U.S. Army, and she was talking about the abuse that her husband faced at the Department of Army. Now, here are our men and women going to protect us, and they're being discriminated and harassed to the point of almost having to be hospitalized. Now, this gentleman, he was at a training session, and they showed a film, and the first thing on the slide projector was a picture of Ben Rhames, the actor, the African-American actor, and they had put niggardly across his chest. And this is at an Army base. So she called in the NAACP. She's called in other people to get her story out, and I was invited as a member of C4C. But there are countless stories that African-Americans are facing. Her husband's trying to serve our country. Had another gentleman. He had come back from the Gulf War. He's a C4C member. Just because he filed an EEO complaint, they exposed him and other employees as well to asbestos, cancer-causing agents. There are so many stories. This needs to be addressed. And the people who are responsible for causing the African-American Gulf War veteran his injury, they were found to be guilty, and nothing happened to them. They just were allowed to leave the agency and go from one agent to the next. And last, I can give you another incident of a gentleman, if you want to call him that. His name was Craig Littlejohn. He was with the U.S. Department of Interior. He discriminated against a gentleman. It's called the Pierre versus Salazar case. He was found guilty of violating the civil rights of Adam Pierre. He called African-American subordinates monkeys. According to the EEOC decision, he banished, if you will, a lot of the subordinate African-Americans under his supervision to field offices. And even after all that, rather than punishing him, penalizing him, we found out what he did get after being found guilty was actually he got a pay increase. 2 weeks after the EEOC found this public official guilty of discrimination and violating the civil rights of a U.S. citizen, he was given a pay increase. And we have that on paper.
Now, this executive order that you want President Obama to sign, he can do this. Republicans can't stop him. He is the president, and he has this right to do it if he wills to do it.
Absolutely. He did similar something to when he did the Lilly Ledbetter Act to encourage fairness with females and women and making sure that they got fair pay. I mean, other presidents have used the executive order as well. And this is really key, too, because he is the head of the executive branch. This is his workforce. And the departments that he oversees touches the very lives of every American. And this is something that should concern all of us. And he can make a difference. And quite frankly, I know sometimes this administration can be very squeamish when it comes to color, but this is beyond the color line. If he were to use this corrective tool to, as we call, unleash no fear, and give that legislation that was introduced in 2002 the teeth and the power that it's supposed to have to hold these managers accountable, it will benefit all Americans.
And have you heard from the White House since you put this petition out there?
We have not yet heard from the White House at this point. We started the campaign, I guess it's been about a week and a half now. We hope to hear, and we're more than willing to work with the administration to make the federal government a better place for not just the civil servants, but to make it a place where we can have better efficiency, better productivity, and better quality of services for the U.S. citizens we are to uphold the public trust for. And I just would like to say again, if everybody can go on change.org and sign the petition, our campaign is called Unleash No Fear. We do have a video out there. If you just Google Unleash No Fear, you'll get a flavor for what this whole campaign entails.
Tanya Ward Jordan of the Coalition for Change, or C4C. The age of austerity is accelerating the loss of public space as much of the public sector becomes privatized or disappears. Black Agenda Report managing editor Bruce Dixon puts much of the blame on what passes for black leadership in America.
On last Friday's super funky Soul Power Hour, the wonderful weekly radio show which the eminent Dr. Jared Ball does on WPFW-FM on Washington, D.C., our friend and comrade Kali Okuno wondered aloud at how he might soon have to explain to his now infant daughter that there used to be these things called public libraries and post offices and even public schools. So what has happened to us? How have the repeal of the New Deal and the Great Society, along with the enclosures of vast new spaces in media and the natural world, become possible? The answer is the elimination of Black America's role as anchor in the left wing of the national policy and the historic defection of black leadership. This has been neatly accomplished by converting the historic black freedom movement from a struggle for a broad spectrum of economic, human, and political rights into a struggle for mere civil rights under law. In this way, with the signing of a few key laws and a handful of court decisions, black leadership declared victory and demobilized the movement that might have transformed America. It was the triumph of the autocratic vision of the NAACP, of Roy Wilkins and Thurgood Marshall, linked to the autocratic style of preachers like Dr. King, over the radical democratic vision of activists like Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, and the young people who led SNCC. To be fair, civil rights victories did sometimes lead to a measure of integration, to some public and private sector affirmative action, to diversity, and certainly to fat contracts for well-connected minority enterprises. But they never raised the minimum wage, or guaranteed a public education of equal quality in poor neighborhoods, or established the constitutional right to a vote, a home, a clean environment, or a job. Certainly, the alleged victory of the civil rights movement did not protect us from the alarming growth of the prison state in the 70s, the 80s, or the 90s. Are there really children who don't deserve quality education, or families that don't deserve homes? Are there really whole neighborhoods identified by a combination of race and class who don't deserve public transit, and a third of whose young men just deserve to be locked up? After the alleged victory of the so-called civil rights movement, the answer is apparently yes. The first places now to lose public schools, public transit, and public libraries are black communities, like those in Detroit, New Orleans, Philly, and now, ominously, Metro Atlanta. It's a failure of black leadership nationally, and in those places, the historic failure of the black political class. After leading us down the blind alley of civil rights under law and securing its own piece of the pie, the black political class of preachers, politicians, business people, and wannabes has walked away from the rest of us. It never did propose alternatives to gentrification, to the warfare state, to environmental racism, or to the fact that every 36 hours, a black person is murdered by law enforcement, by private security forces, or by vigilantes. And it never, never led discussions over, let alone fights against, the privatization of education and everything else that's left to steal. Our black leaders did know how to celebrate the 60s and the victories of the civil rights movement, and how to get paid. And that was about all. And that's how we lost the public schools, the public libraries, and public transit.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda TV. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.